The death of God is about the drying up of a horizon of meaning and of a whole form of human life.
Where do we stand in the illusion it makes? What kind of space are we invited into?
The material relations between people become social relations between things. When we look at toasters, corn, and TVs, we don't
to a large extent, live in the interregnum between worlds, if you will, or between paradigms. Not many people in the history of the world have faced that.
Zero Squared is the Zero Books podcast. This week's episode of Zero Squared features a conversation with Anja Clard from the Marxist Humanist Initiative and the activist Ravi Bali. The people at the Marxist Humanist Initiative have published a number of statements on the dangers of Donald Trump in their journal, With Sober Senses. And in this conversation, I attempt to test their ideas and seek out inconsistencies. You'll hear that this is a more contentious conversation than is the norm. And the reason for that is simple. I respect these obscure Marxists. I want them to win, and so I find it necessary to critique them ruthlessly. That said, you'll find that the conversation ends rather suddenly. I've edited out a bit of the more contentious part, the bit where I find myself suddenly changing the subject. Regular listeners to this podcast will miss that bit, because I think I go off the rails. But I will include it in this week's Members Only Inside Zero Books podcast. On that subject, thanks goes out again to the Zero Books Club members. I want to encourage everyone to join. Zero Books Club members gain access to a second podcast each week, and this is called the Inside Zero Books podcast. It sometimes features a second hour from this podcast, or at least a second section, maybe not a full hour, and sometimes features conversations about the left and left publishing with members of the Zero Books editorial team. I'm Douglas Lane, the publisher of Zero Books and the host of this podcast. And in just a moment, you'll hear me shouting at Marxists.
This is Anja Clard. I'm with Marxist Humanist Initiative, and I'm a very old revolutionary and Marxist humanist. I have a very long history in the freedom movements in the U.S. from civil rights days, feminism, through anti-war, through all kinds of things. And here we are today in 2016, protesting in the streets of New York and elsewhere over Donald Trump. It's still hard to believe the whole thing.
My name's Ravi, Ravi Bali. I'm based in the UK, and I've been a revolutionary for a long time, not quite as long as Anne, but, you know, a fair while myself. I see kind of what's going on in America as part of some disturbing developments that are taking place across the world, but let's deal with America for now.
We're going to be talking about the MHI editorial, The Extraordinary Dangers of Trump and Trumpism. But before we start with that, I just kind of wanted to tell you about a conversation I had about, a little bit less than an hour ago. I just got off the line with Bill Ivey, who is a former NEA chairman under Bill Clinton and George Bush, and friend of John Podesta. And I talked to him, hoping to get sort of an insider's view as to what had happened and why Trump won and what had gone wrong. And he seemed to put the responsibility for Trump's ascendancy on the shoulders of the Washington consensus and the way that both Democrats and Republicans run campaigns along demographic lines. And he said that the difficulty was that this was a populist moment for the country, and the Democrats ran a traditional candidate, And that's the sentiment I'm hearing from most of the left flank of the Democratic Party, too, when I try to listen to people who are kind of Bernie bros. Their idea is that somebody like Sanders or Elizabeth Warren would have captured the imagination of the segment of the population that was consequential in this election, gotten more Democrats to the polls, and beaten Trump. Do you think that this is true? And do you think that support for Sanders or Elizabeth Warren comes from the working class?
I don't think we can say exactly what went wrong. It was certainly a perfect storm of all kinds of things: economic discontent, racism, xenophobia, and the stupid, archaic system of the Electoral College. You know, Clinton's up in the popular vote by more than 2 million votes, and it keeps increasing. They haven't finished counting them all. So it was, in that sense, the difference between one or the other winning was very, very chancy and extraordinary misfortune. I am not one who wants to blame the Democrats for doing something wrong. I think they did their normal thing. I don't know that if they'd done something else, it would have been more credible than what they did do. And I certainly don't think running Sanders or Warren would have made all the difference. Trump would have obviously engaged in enormous red baiting of them and his devoted followers, who believed every lie he said, would have eaten that up and possibly eaten up Sanders and Warren. So I don't think it's a question of choosing a better Democrat. I think it's a question of proposing if you're saying what would we do, we would pose a completely different alternative than between these two parties.
You know, I have that question, but that's not the question I asked yet. So let me just push back a little bit on this, because I definitely agree that Trump would have done some red baiting and a lot of it. But if the problem in this election was that too many working class people and people of color stayed home, and too many people who had voted for, say, Obama in the last election and who were under economic distress either switched to Trump or didn't vote at all, those two things, then it's conceivable to me that a socialist message would have been appealing to our base. I mean, it's not as though, as you pointed out, it's not as though more people voted for Trump than had voted before. In fact, he got less support. Fewer people voted for him than voted for Romney. So, in terms of what the outcome would have been, I'm not sure that there's a good case to say that, that red baiting would have been effective for the people who needed to be moved to go to the polls.
I think part of the difficulty here is that if you restrict yourself entirely to electoral politics, then perhaps you're right. But the difficulty is that even if they had someone who was able to articulate the problems of the economy and suggest something akin to some Keynesian sort of redistribution efforts and promise the same sort of infrastructural projects that Trump came up with, you've got to remember that it's not like any of these things are going to fix the underlying problems of American capitalism. That those problems are deeply rooted in structural issues that are not open to political solutions at that level. And so whoever was running against them has to be able to articulate something that hasn't been done before, that can still stand out as credible, that people are going to think, okay, I buy this as being able to make a difference. Now, Trump had a twin-track strategy. You've got the use of racism and scapegoating and the offer to be the best jobs president ever, that he will do all these infrastructure projects. Mm-hmm. Now, you cannot separate one from the other. And those who kind of selectively say, okay, we will ignore the racism and just hope that his message of, you know, I'm going to do this, that, and the other will actually lift America out of the problems that it has got now and will make it great again. And if you choose to ignore the racism, when those solutions don't work, then at least Trump has got something to fall back on and say, well, this section of society is responsible for not allowing us to make America great. That scapegoating is absolutely central to what he's about. For the left to offer some kind of social democratic program that was going to offer the same that would also have failed, what are they going to fall back on? So, okay, maybe on this election cycle, you might have been able to stop him, but what's to prevent something like him in the future? As long as we've got capitalism, you've got the difficulty that there are no solutions that will deliver for the majority of us that can be sustained. And that has to be borne in mind. So I think you can't just address the question purely in terms of what could have stopped Trump this time. It's more, what is it that is going to prevent reaction and the turn towards scapegoating and racism on a broader level? Okay. And that is not, that's not what any of the Democrats can offer.
But it seemed to me that the essay absolutely thought it was an imperative that we stop Trump this time and in the future. But this time was an imperative. I mean, it was not as though, because there's an argument from parts of the left, not the parts that I think this essay directly addressed, but from parts of the left that say, well, better get it now and have this out and accelerate the problem so that we can see what it is and see where this leads and not have the false hope of a Bernie Sanders so that we can start the revolution, basically. But that isn't the MHI position.
No, it certainly is not. That sounds very much like after Hitler, us, the position of some of the communists in Europe at the end of World War II, that they thought, well, that now that they should make things worse under Hitler and then they'd be a reaction in their favor later. That's crazy. Yeah. Meanwhile, Hitler almost destroyed the world, and Trump could very well destroy the world. Nobody in their right mind could possibly say that. First of all, the demographics are against the kind of coalition that he put together. They're against the Republican Party in any way, shape, and form. And they realize that the country is getting more and more immigrants. There are more and more Latino voters coming of age. And so if they didn't win this time, they're only going to get to be fewer and fewer and never have another chance. And that's why he's so eager to close the borders and deport the Latinos before they come of voting age, and impose more and more voting restrictions and continue the trend towards voter suppression that's been going on for some years now, but was exacerbated by the Supreme Court killing the 1965 voting rights law just recently. And so this was, I think, their last hurrah.
Which is it? Is it his last hurrah, or is he going to be a continued threat into the future, regardless of the outcome of this election? Because Ravi just said one thing, and now you're saying something completely different.
There's always a threat from extreme right-wingers. There's a threat from people who like autocrats and dictators to continue that kind of thing. But I think that they would be outvoted as the demographics change in any future election. Of course, Trump may change all the rules. Who knows what he's going to do? He may abrogate the Constitution. He may find ways to demolish the other parties as well as the left so that he gets a clear shot at a long-term presidency. But in the end, eventually, those people are not going to have the numbers they would need to win a normal, fairly won election.
Because here's what I'm getting from this so far, is that on the one hand, Sanders, with his populist rhetoric, promising Keynesian solutions, which wouldn't work, which I completely agree wouldn't. He was a threat because he would fail, and then the next Keynesian to come along would be someone like Trump. Trump obviously is a horrible threat. He's completely unstable as a person, and then the forces behind him are, to say that they're reactionary is an understatement. They're racist and they're scapegoating and they're reactionary. So of the three options, it sounds like maybe what you two would think is the best option is actually Clinton or someone like Clinton winning. That there's no, that there's no offer from the capitalist class then of any kind of actual economic solution or addressing, they wouldn't be directly addressing any of the economic concerns. They would continue to support the demographics amongst the upper classes that we want to support, the, you know, the they would have good policies there. And it would give us time to organize. Is that the position?
I don't understand your question, Doug.
My question was, is that your position?
No, we weren't supporting Clinton. We were opposing Trump. And we think think the danger of Trump in power is so great that everybody should have pulled together as need be to defeat Trump.
But of the three choices, though, Trump, Sanders, or Clinton, which one would have been the least risky and the most helpful for a Marxist project?
Anyone except Trump.
Look,
out of those three, there is no preference between Trump or Clinton as to who would be better for the ability to self-organize, because neither of them are like authoritarian demagogues who actually threaten the safety of anyone that opposes them.
You mean Sanders and Clinton, not Trump and Clinton?
Yeah, sorry, Sanders and Clinton. They don't represent that. Trump does. He actually represents a threat to anybody who wants to organize to create a movement for a better society. And in that sense, he is an immediate threat and an immediate danger that we need to organize to stop basically fucking us over. That's pretty straightforward.
Yeah, I agree with you that Trump is a terrible threat. I'm just trying to figure out what this self-organizing entails and what would be the best conditions. And it sounded to me like up until this point that you'd felt that Sanders was a kind of a unique threat and would actually end up supporting Trump in the long term, that would set up Trump, a Sanders win, in ways that maybe a Clinton win wouldn't. So I was asking if that's true. But it sounds like Clinton and Sanders would equally lead to a future Trump if they had won.
I don't think we said anything remotely like who would be setting up the situation for a future Trump.
Well, you did, because I asked about Sanders, and Ravi did suggest that a Sanders win would be setting up the possibility of a future Trump.
No, capitalism does that. Does that in a way that it cannot.
Right, because of the capitalist conditions, a Sanders victory would set up a future Trump. So you did say that.
He didn't say that it would any more than a Clinton victory.
No, I know, which
he
is what
said,
I was asking.
He just
which
said
is
the
why
problems
I asked about
of,
Clinton, whether that would be different. The answer is no. So, okay, that's fine.
No, we don't. We didn't favor one over the other. We had enormous criticisms of Clinton and of Sanders and of everyone else who was running. We could go into the false alternatives proposed by the third parties. None of them would have been able to solve the problems that the working class has under capitalism, nor can they solve any of the other problems, probably. But in any event, Doug, nobody cares who we would have liked to see win. Who cares?
I care about that.
The thing was to defeat Trump. The Democrats failed to do so. The third parties and the people on the left who set a plague on both your houses and thought they had to be so pristine and pure that they could never vote for Democrats, even if their lives depend on it, which now it may, and they should have. Those people set up and aided Trump to win, and it's not a question of our saying someone else would have done better. I don't think someone else would have done better.
We went over, obviously, Trump is horrible. Sanders, because of his Keynesian policies wouldn't work, would set up someone like Trump in the future. So my question naturally was, would Clinton have been less dangerous than Sanders? So the answer you're giving me is no.
I wouldn't choose between them in terms of what they might set up. They're not setting it up. The forces of capitalism are setting it up. And they're all in this boat, and the boat of electoral politics that can't have any solutions.
It can't have any solutions, but it can maybe at least kick the can down the road. And the further you can kick the can down the road, the better.
Well, no, as I indicated, I think the Trump victory was the Republicans' last stand, that their party's is devastated. I shouldn't just say it's going to be, because look at how fragmented it is. A lot of them are running to kiss Trump's ass to get in with him, but they're never going to have a common platform. The old days of the Republicans representing a certain conservatism and certain economic policies and all that's gone forever. So this was the last chance, and the last chance for the right-wing elements, not just Republicans, but the Tea Party and everyone else. And of course, now we have the racists and the Ku Klux Klan as major players. This was, I think, their last chance, their perfect storm situation to actually win. And they did win.
Do you think that Trump is a Republican in any conventional sense?
No. There's nothing. He's not an economic conservative. He's not a neoliberal. All the old labels that you would have kind of seen as central to just like lifting all Americans rhetorically out of the economic problems that the country faced, Trump didn't appeal to any of that. He basically, as I say, had a twin track strategy: play up the racism and say he's going to be a jobs president. If you examine the jobs president aspect of it, that's not the distinctive part. The distinctive part is the racism, the xenophobia, the misogyny, all of the stuff that is playing to the worst aspects of kind of American culture. He has ramped that up as a way of saying, look, all the things that are wrong in American society are due to the liberal elites, and he's attacked the status quo from a racist and xenophobic position.
So if he's not a traditional Republican, why is it that he represents the Republicans' last stand? It doesn't seem to me that he actually represents the interests of the Republican Party as I've understood them. He uses maybe some of the same electoral strategies, which again goes to like dividing and conquering and playing to demographics and things, but he doesn't represent the interests of the Republican Party, as I understand it, which is basically the interest of certain sectors of capital.
But he now controls the Republican Party, and he controls the Republican congressmen and senators, and he's going to appoint conservative Republicans to the courts. He's in control. So it doesn't matter what you label it. I was just using the term Republican Party.
Yeah, but I wasn't going after these other things you're saying. I was going after what you said about him being the last stand of the Republican Party. I agree with you that he didn't, that he has he has executive power, and the executive branch has been inflated since 9/11. And, you know, the powers of that branch are already unconstitutional and out of control. You put Trump there, it's an extraordinary danger. So you're getting no pushback from me on that. What I was asking about was whether or not it's best to understand Trump in terms of him being the last stand of a certain demographic in this country that the Republicans have in some ways claimed to represent.
First of all, I'm not trying to understand Trump.
My father taught me many things here. He taught me in this room. He taught me, keep your friends close, but your enemies closer.
This guy said, if you are ignorant of both your enemy and yourself, then you are a fool and certain to be defeated in every battle. So you don't know the enemy, you don't know who you're fighting, and you don't know yourself, meaning like you don't know your strengths, your weaknesses, anything about you. You never did that critical thinking about yourself, nor the enemy. So you are a fool, and you will lose no matter what. I mean, you will lose every battle that you fight. So if you know yourself, but not your enemy, so you did the critical thinking on yourself, you know your strengths, your weaknesses, you gauged what can be done and things like that, but you don't know your enemy. So for every battle won, in that case, for every battle won, you will suffer a loss. 50-50 chance of winning a game or winning a war, whatever. If you know your enemy and yourself, you will win every battle. So this guy is saying like, you know yourself and you know your enemy, so you will win every war.
See, one of my concerns here is that if we attack Trump the wrong way, we end up being as divisive or risk dividing people who need to be brought together ourselves, and it's being sort of self-defeating is what I want to avoid. That's why I'm pushing you guys so hard here. I feel like a lot of this approach to Trump was tried by the Clinton administration during the election, and it blew up in their face. So to repeat it now seems like a big mistake.
Doug, I think you're chasing up the wrong tree here. We are not people who can set policy for the what the major discourse going on in the country should be. That's the Democrats have to figure out what they can do. The unions have to figure out what they can do. Black movement has to figure out what they can do, etc. Mm-hmm. But what we see our role is first of all, pointing out the dangers of Trumpism, which it boggles the mind that people are still saying, well, maybe he won't be so bad when he's busily implementing everything he promised.
I know, but he's not busily implementing everything he promised. When you say that, you sound crazily partisan. I think he will implement a lot of what he's promised, but at the moment, what he's been doing in the press is backtracking off of the things that he's promised. He's not going to go after Clinton and indict her. Thank God. He's saying he's not going to just deport 11 million people like he had originally promised. Thank God. Now, I don't think that that lessens his risk at all, and I don't believe that we should believe him. But if you just say he's busily implementing everything he promised, you're saying the opposite of the truth, which undermines you.
First of all, it's not important in the larger scheme of things whether he tries to indict Clinton or not. And nobody cares all that much, I don't think, except maybe his base will demand that he do. He has not backed off his immigration policy. He said he'll only deport 3 million to start with. He has not said that he's given up his plan to deport a total of, I don't know if it's 11 million or it got up to 16 million in all. And there's no reason to think he would back down.
Any part of the law that you might be able to change that would accommodate those people that contribute to society, have been law-abiding, have kids here, would there be any room in your mind, or you, because I know you had a meeting this week with Hispanic leaders.
I did. I had a meeting with great people, great Hispanic leaders, and there certainly can be a softening because we're not looking to hurt people. We want people. We have some great people in this country. We have some great, great people in this country.
Why lead with these sort of partisan-sounding attacks on Trump when you could lead with he's a proto-fascist?
We thought we were saying that, but we were giving the proof because at the time we wrote our editorial and continuing, but at the time we wrote it, a lot of people were saying, well, maybe he's not so bad. I don't feel like voting for a Democrat. I'm too pure to vote for a Democrat, even if it's a matter of saving the country from fascism. That's why we were writing the editorial. Now, everything we said in the editorial has come true in terms of the left being foolish not to oppose him with all their might. And now we're stuck with him, probably. And now what do we do? And what we don't do is give him another chance and another chance when we haven't the slightest reason to think he's going to change his ways. What we want to do is to stop him. And I think we should be talking about that and talking about what can be done and particularly what kind of rethinking the left needs to do to be any help in this whole matter instead of a hindrance and instead of poking holes in this or that statement of the people who oppose him.
Look, here's the thing. I'm not like this in any interview. I do not do this. It's not how I approach interviewing or discourse. I'm being harder on you guys because I want you to be right. I want to win. When you say something like, oh, this guy's opinion about Islam and Islamic people is racist, you're treating him like a normal politician. That's not going to work against these people. That what we have to do is get, you can't guilt, people into disliking Trump. You can't say, oh, they've got the wrong opinions. You've got to say, hey, these people are dangerous to you. These people are dangerous to this country. These people are not in any way ordinary. This is not a partisan debate.
And that's exactly what we said in both our editorial and in the statement we wrote since on the 15th, both of which can be found on our website, MarxistHumanistInitiative.org, under our publication. We said exactly these things. We have no interest in partisan politics. We have interest in trying to save the people of the U.S. and maybe the world if he starts unleashing nuclear weapons. So, but let me say one other thing about what harm he's done, because you seem to indicate either he hasn't done any harm yet, or
I didn't say that. I said that when you argue that he's all I said was when you argue that he is implementing every promise he makes, anyone who's been paying attention to the news is going to think, oh, she doesn't know what she's talking about, which is because he's been backing off all those promises.
No, he hasn't been backing off. He's been saying maybe he'll soften his stand as this or that. We don't know, but he has not backed off anything except maybe prosecuting Clinton. And who cares? But let me say what else. Yeah, he can change his mind. What else he's done is he has created the most terror in the country among the immigrants, among the black people, among the Muslims. A number of hate crimes has gone up astronomically since the election. There have been more hate crimes against Muslims than there were following 9/11. When there were quite a few. Mm-hmm. The children are crying in the classrooms at school because they're going to have their parents deported or they'll be deported. The other children of the Trump voters are learning the most horrible racist things. They're yelling, build the wall at the Latino students. They're yelling, deport them all at the Muslims. It's just the most horrendous experience for children, and who knows if they'll ever recover from that. So he's done plenty of harm already, and he has done nothing to stop that kind of action. He once said, oh, that's bad about hate crimes. You should stop that. You know, why doesn't he use some of his power that he's already got to speak to people about it and then loudly condemn these things? He doesn't want to. He's happy to keep whipping up frenzies and keeping the attention on himself, no matter how outrageous it is. You know, today or yesterday, he said, the Democrats have been engaged in voter fraud and in response to the new investigation of what happened in three key states that went for him on very tiny, tiny margins. He said, oh, the Democrats have engaged in millions of cases of voter fraud. That's a complete lie. There's been almost no voter fraud documented. There were 10 cases 2000 to 2012. There were no cases 2012 to 2016 of voter impersonation, which is the kind of thing he's talking about. You know, there are other ways to commit fraud, but that's the way. That's what he's talking about, individuals walking in, voting twice, voting at different places, and all that kind of, it's a total lie. It's always been a lie. The Republicans have been yelling it for years, and they yell it in order to pass more and more onerous voting requirements because they think that black people won't be able to meet them and Latinos won't be able to meet them, like having to have picture registrations and all that. And we're back to the pre-civil rights movement days when you couldn't vote in the South if you were black. You could not qualify to register. You had to answer how many bubbles in a bar of soap to pass a test to register. And that's what he wants to go back to. And all that is happening. He's giving the green light to the most reactionary elements in the state. He wants to give the power of who can have an abortion back to the states, or so he says. He's going to get the Supreme Court to knock out Roe versus Wade, and it'll go back to the states, because the states have a lot of Republicans or worse conservatives, Tea Party people in control. And women are going to lose all their rights, and blacks are going to lose all their rights. And we need to organize to fight this right now. I'm not suggesting I have an organization that's going to lead the march against him. What I have is an organization that's appealing to the left to get its head on straight and to stop making excuses for him and to stop thinking they have to figure out what to tell the workers and to lead them on.
One of the things that's troubling is that the left's response to Trump's victory is to say that, well, we need to understand the white working class and that you've got to somehow understand the pain and the kind of disillusionment they've got with the political process and how Trump was able to play on that. And even the way in which they are framing the response to Trump's victory is accepting the divisions that he has already exacerbated. I'm not saying that he created them. Those kind of divisions existed previously, but he has exacerbated them and he has benefited from them. And if you start discussing things in terms of a white working class, you are already kind of stymied as to how you may formulate a response, because accepting a class as something that can be divided along racial lines, of course you've got white workers, but the idea of a working class is supposed to be, in political terms, something that overcomes those divisions in order to fight for the interests of everybody. It's a universalist claim. As soon as you kind of talk about a white working class, which is separate from a black working class or Latino, you've taken away that universalist element and you've made it something that's, you know, it's particular, it's got racial characteristics, and it's no longer all-inclusive. And the fact that the left are responding in that way, and the form of their analysis is to say we need to understand the pain of the white working class, it's already accepting the divisions that we need to struggle to overcome. And that's really dangerous. And I think part of our role is to combat ideas like that that frame the explanation for why Trump won in such divisive terms.
If we had said we need to understand the pain of the Latino working class, would you say the same thing?
Yeah.
Yes.
You would?
Yeah.
Yes. There are not separate working classes in the U.S. There's one U.S. working class, and it's got many different ethnicities, genders, et cetera, in it.
It is
those who are exercising their racism and sexism and xenophobia who are destroying the unity of that class.
I would take that one step further and say there is one working class across the world, and that to accept the divisions across nation or racial grounds is problematic. And that, in fact, what we need to articulate is why we have a common cause rather than accepting the divisions that, you know, people like Trump play on.
I remember in one of the essays, not the one that we're discussing, there being a line where it said we need to help. Oh, here it is. We need to help African Americans, Latino women, and other workers, the LGBTQ and other workers, at the end of one of the pieces, which seemed to me to say was saying African American workers, Latino workers, women workers, LGBTQ workers, and others.
Yeah, all workers.
You were mentioning African American workers, Latino workers, women workers.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes. But sometimes even if they're not at the moment working, they're workers because they have no power and no ability to control or obtain means of production to work. So we recognize the validity of independent movements of black people, women, etc. And we think they have things to bring to the revolution aside from the fact that they are workers and working class, which they are also.
Okay.
But we think there are particular things brought.
So why doesn't that same critique that you said about when the left wants to talk about white workers, why doesn't that apply when the left wants to talk about African American workers or Latino workers?
Doug,
you critique can talk about- is against saying they're separate working classes. The critique is not against discussing them and their particular contributions separately.
But the Thomas Frank, when he said, or Matt Taibbi, or whatever his name is, when he says we need to understand what's happening to the white working class, he's not saying that the working class, that they're separate any more than someone saying we need to understand what's happening to women workers is saying that their concerns are separate from other workers. Unless you mean that they suffer some different kinds of effects in concrete terms.
Like Marx's kind of phrase about workers of the world unite, you have nothing to lose but your chains. Mm-hmm. That is the working class is a political category rather just simply a sociological or a descriptive one. Mm-hmm. So in order for the working class to achieve its freedom, it needs to unite. And if you talk about the working class as like having separate races or like whatever, you've already accepted the divisions that exist. Now, I'm not saying that workers aren't divided, but the working class as a category is something that is as much an aspiration as to what needs to be achieved as it is something that has a content in terms of describing what exists. It's an aspiration rather than a description.
Maybe I should make the argument for you. I think the problem is that in America and maybe across the world, working class is taken to be synonymous with white working class a good portion of the time in our politics. So you talk about African American problems, but you don't talk about African American working class problems. Or when you say working class in the American context, often enough, people take you to mean that you're talking about white workers. It's like the only category that white people have where they can claim to be oppressed. Therefore, when you talk about the working class or you say we need to talk about class, people think you're saying we need to talk about white people.
Some people do think that. Yeah. Marxist Humanist Initiative never talks like that.
Yeah, I know. You're fighting against that.
We talk against that, but I think it's really only old leftists that still think that the real worker is the male white industrial worker. We haven't had that in the majority for decades. So I think most people, if they think about it, know that all the service workers, all the other workers who were especially Black and Latino, many, certainly more, there are more of them than there are white workers left in the working class or in the category of workers. Also, I don't agree with Thomas Frank and others who want to attribute everything to economic position. I think the left has fallen into, recently in analyzing this business, has fallen into a kind of economism where now everything is about being left out of the American dream and being not having your wages frozen and having your children not able to do as well as you instead of better than you like they used to do in the old age. And what happens when you just focus on that analysis is that race drops out and suddenly racism isn't such a problem in the U.S. And it is a huge problem in the U.S. And I think that that needs to be talked about and can never be talked about too much because it's been the Achilles heel of this country since colonial days, since slavery. It's marked everything that's happened. It's killed every radical movement eventually. We had a great progressive movement in the 1870s, 80s, 90s, and it was Black and white together in the beginning. There were 1.25 million Black farmers involved. And then racist leaders managed to take control and split it up. And it died. And there are 1 million examples in U.S. history where racism has proved to kill movements. And there are many times when Blacks and whites were together, and it's at those points that great leaps are made in progressive actions in the U.S. and then potentially revolutionary ones.
I took Thomas Frank and others to be saying that we needed to think about the white working class in the Rust Belt, not because it justified their Trump vote, but because it was a point of common ground between black workers and white workers, that that if you start to see that what's motivating even someone who seems to be your enemy is the same system of oppression, you might be able to join together in common struggle more easily. And the other thing is, you know, Thomas Frank isn't writing for.
Can I just deal with that, though?
Hold on a second. He isn't writing for women workers in some sort of textile factory. He's writing for the political class, and really kind of is a critic of the Democratic Party. So he's trying to tell them what they need to do to have a more universalist message so they can beat a populist like Trump.
If you try and fold political struggles for equality into the struggle for economic justice, you are missing the whole problem of oppression, because even though they are both related to capitalism, they have a slightly different relationship to it. So if your advocacy of like something that can address everybody at once, and the way in which you just posed it, that black and white workers have in common that they need a functioning economy with plenty of jobs, then you go along with the idea that a rising tide lifts all boats. Now, the problem is that rising tide and that ability to sustain the economy so that everyone benefits, rising tide that lifts all boats is not something that can be sustained. So if you fold the political struggles for equality into the struggle for economic justice, and you say that, well, actually, racism, you know, it doesn't need to be tackled separately. You don't have to tackle like the denial of equality to women, or like the denial of rights to lesbian and gay people, or whatever the form of political equality is. If you suggest that the broader struggle for economic justice will take care of all those things, then you are accepting divisions within the working class that need to be overcome, because capitalism itself cannot deliver that. And to suggest that some kind of strategy in which you accept those divisions rather than uniting people around a system or a struggle that can remove all hierarchies within society and the need to overthrow capitalism in order to achieve that, you need to address the divisions that they continually sow between workers of different types. So if you allow people like Trump to set white against black or white against Latino or men against women, all those divisions will come back to bite you in the ass because you're not overcoming them. Those political struggles for equality are extremely important to keep in the struggle to create a new society. If you kind of put them on the back burner or say that somehow they can be relegated to a second division of concern, you're fucked. You're not going to get anywhere.
See, but I'm not saying that. No one's saying that. Here's the thing. I mean, some people might be saying that. I'm certainly not saying that. And I don't think Thomas Frank was saying that either. And I don't think most of the people who are saying, hey, you got to take a look at the conditions that white people are suffering in, Flint, Michigan, not just white people, actually whites and blacks alike in Flint, Michigan, because it's not just white people in the Rust Belt.
I will tell you that I think there needs to be a profound change in the way the Democratic Party does business. It is not good enough to have a liberal elite. I come from the white working class, and I am deeply humiliated that the Democratic Party cannot talk to the people from where I came from.
Joining me now is Thomas Frank, the author of Listen, Liberal, or Whatever Happened to the Party of the People. Tom, it's great to have you here.
It's my pleasure.
Congrats on the book. I've been reading it. You sent me an early copy. I think it's extremely provocative. It's fantastically written, as all Tom Frank products are.
Very kind of you, sir.
Let's talk about Trump particularly in this context, right? You wrote this piece for The Guardian basically saying, you liberals, you get some of the blame for this. Why?
Because it basically goes back to inequality and to the sort of larger question of the relationship of the Democratic Party with the working class, specifically the white working class, which is a question that goes back to the 1970s. But it's a story that I trace in the book. There's a long backstory to this, and what I end up with is at some point the Democrats, the kind of elite Washington Democrats that Katrina was referring to a few minutes ago, decided that they didn't want to be the party of working people anymore. That really wasn't who they were. That's not what they were about anymore. And this took a long time, from the 70s, the 80s, and it sort of comes to it flowers with Bill Clinton. And who they were instead was they were a party of the professional class.